All right. Y'all would grab a seat. We have more super fun, happy things to talk about. I'll give everybody just a second. So if you're late to class, you're going to have to be a role model. So come on up for role play. No, just kidding. I'm the guy at RTS that likes being on time. I'm that guy. So me and Barb, yeah. Dr. Hurley, don't raise your hands. Definitely Bill, no. No. Likes to be on time. Oh my goodness. Yeah. So if you're thinking about being a student here, Dr. Hurley and Dr. Richardson live, it's this time vortex where all normal time ceases to exist. It's this whole different, you know, dimension. So, do we got everybody almost? We're good enough. All right, good deal. So, I want to do an exercise. I want you to look to your right, see the person on your right. All right, stretch your neck out. Now look to the person on your left. There is one. Okay, two of the three of you uses pornography, statistically. So, if you're not using it, the people on your left and right are. So, statistically, that's what it is. Now, you would probably say, but wait a minute, I'm sitting on a row of just females. Statistically, it's got to be different, right? Nope, it's the same. Two out of three females under the age of 30 also use pornography regularly. And then you're like, but wait a minute, we're in a Christian institution. There's no way us Bible-believing Christians do this. There's no way it's the same. It's exactly the same. So two out of three, typically, statistically, Christians are using pornography. So who uses pornography? Two out of three people, basically, is kind of what it comes down to. A lot of people use pornography. Again, a lot of these statistics are coming from 5 to 10 years ago. It's worse, and it's directly influenced by high-speed internet. It's like there's direct correlations. It's not a mystery. That makes it more of a hook, more addictive, that kind of thing. So we are, just to let you know, just to kind of remind you, I'm going to talk about what it is, why people use it, and then we will talk about how do we help people. Like, it's not totally hopeless. How do we help people? So, who uses pornography? Porn sites get more visitors each month than Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined. So raise your hand if you have Amazon. Okay, raise your hand if you have Twitter, if you waste your time there. Feeling hopeless about all things political. All right, raise your hand if you have Netflix. Okay, raise your hand if you use pornography. Just kidding. Wouldn't do that to you. Think about how much time you use on those three things. It's a lot. Pornography, porn sites get more visitors each month than those three combined. It was back in 2013, so it's I think it's probably worse. You could probably throw Facebook up there with it now. So here's some statistics. Pornhub is it's the hub of porn on the internet. Do not ever search that term. If you were to go to Pornhub, you would see things on the main page that would absolutely shock you. That the stuff I talked about earlier, it's main page stuff. It's not five pages later, you know, at the back of the newspaper. It's like, no, that's the front cover story stuff. So here's some statistics. Pornhub is kind of the main thing. It's the mainstream pornography website. It's not the dark web stuff. This is just the normal people in your office, people in your church, friends. This is the thing most of them are using. So here's some statistics. And these come, I think, from 2017. So it's, again, 2 years, so it's outdated. So 81 million daily average visits. 81 million, right? Our country has, 350 million, something like that? So it's a chunk of the population here and across the world. Daily visits. 25 billion searches performed in all time. This is 2017. It's significantly more now. 50,000 searches per minute. If you're like Michael Scott, you may think, how many is that per hour? Good. Some relevant people in here. Good. 800 searches a second. So in 2017, there were 68 years worth of content uploaded. Meaning, if you sat down and watched pornography on Pornhub for 24 hours a day, it'd take you 68 years to watch all of it. But by that end of that 68 years, it would probably be 400,000 more years of pornography. So there's so much stuff. A lot of it's made by amateurs, right? Guys that talk their girlfriends into doing stuff. That's a lot of what you're going to find there. We're going to hit a ton of statistics. Again, I'm going to give you something later. I'll give you a link to this slideshow. You can find all the stuff. So male pornography use. This was Barna Group. I think almost all of these are going to be from 2014-16. So just take it with a grain of salt. Barna Group is also a really conservative research group. So these are all very conservative estimates. At least once a month. 18 to 30-year-old guys. It is 79% use it at least once a month. 31 to 49-year-old guys, 67% of them. And now I'm going to say 50 to 68-year-old guys. How many of them use porn? I want you to get that number in your head. How many do you think 50 to 68-year-old men use pornography at least once a month? 49%. So that's per month. Now let's look per week. The same, we're still with guys, male pornography use. So 18, 30-year-old guys, once per week, 63% of them. So this is 18 and above, right? So this is not teenagers. We'll talk about them later. 31 to 49-year-olds, it's 38% of them. 50 to 68-year-olds, it is 25%. So you think about these numbers, right? So these are the guys that grew up, 50 to 68-year-old guys are the guys that grew up with Playboy, maybe Hustler, but primarily Playboy, right? So very softcore stuff. There's not nearly the hook. 31 to 49-year-old guys, those are guys like me. Those are guys that grew up with the internet, access to the internet around adolescence, like Playboys and stuff as kids. 18 to 30-year-olds grew up with internet access from the time they were kids. They didn't have smartphones, probably, though, right? So you think about the trajectory of this. If we did, which I wish there was, I just couldn't find it, like 10 or even 15 to 18-year-olds, people that grew up with smartphone access since they were little kids, it would be significantly more. So you may think, all right, that's guys. Guys are so sex-driven. There's no way this is the same for females, right? There's no way. So, right? No. 18 to 30-year-olds, nearly the same, 75%. So 3 out of 4 18 to 30-year-old females are using pornography at least once a month. This is talking primarily about visual pornography. I think if we were talking about written pornography, right, it would be probably higher. 31 to 49-year-old, so a big decline there, 16%. And then 50 to 68-year-olds, it's 4% of women. So what does this mean? It means women are not immune to it, right? Young women are just as sexualized, over-sexualized. It's not over that de-porn kind of sexualization, more so than we would think. So at least several times per week. This is a big difference, right? So women don't use it per week nearly as much. 21% of 18 to 30-year-olds, 5% of 31 to 49-year-olds, and 0% of 50 to 68-year-old women use pornography at least several times per week. So what about married people, right? When you're married, kind of that false belief I had, if I get married, it's just going to take all this away. It'll just disappear. Married men, 55% of married men say they watch porn at least once a month, compared to 70% of unmarried men. And so this is the whole, right? So this is from 18 up, kind of put it together. So with women, again, it's got to be different, right? It's got to be different. We really, really want to think women don't use porn. Like, we are obsessed, particularly in the church, we were just determined that if we believe it hard enough, women don't use porn. But they do. It's not nearly as much, 25% of married women. I may have got that wrong. I think that's 16% of married women. I flipped those around. And 25% of unmarried women use pornography at least once per month. And I would say, in my experience, and so that this is stepping away from research, right? My experience, that is almost, married women is almost entirely made up of women whose husbands are getting them to do it. There's so much we could talk about there. So, this is crazy, this one. So looking at porn before puberty, and you think about what's going on. Your body is not prepared for it. We've got 4 kids, the oldest just started driving. She's a sophomore. So she's learning to drive. I'm learning to pray and to shut up. Not very good at either one of those. she's learning to drive. Imagine, though, with my 9-year-old son, who can't pay attention for more than, like, 14 seconds. If I said, hey, man, here's the truck, or here's the keys to my truck. I need you to run down the road. You know, it's like, I guess from here, like, I need you to run up to Madison, pick this up for me, bring it back. What would happen to my son, 9 years old, who's physically, mentally, emotionally not capable of driving a truck? What would happen to him if he jumps on I-55? He and everybody else is dead, right? I mean, there's no chance he's not going to crash. Even, like, rational, healthy adults are going to crash on 55. There's a lot of similarities between pornography and 55. There's a ton of similarities. So, but you think about, like, what happens to a person when they view pornography before their body is capable of being sexual? What happens to them? I don't totally know. I just know it does a lot of bad stuff. I told you earlier, for me, everything became sexualized. I'm going to talk specifically to this later. But before puberty, think again, technological advances. So 51 to 69-year-olds, these are guys who grew up where you would have to put a hoodie on and you'd have to sneak through and make sure none of your church friends see you at the porn store, and you'd have to pick it up and not look at anybody and sneak it out and take it home. That's that age group, right? How many of them saw pornography before puberty? 6%. The next group, the 31 to 50-year-old guys, these are the guys who magazines are more prevalent. VHS is much more prevalent. They probably grew up with some sort of recorded pornography at home. HBO, Showtime, those came out in this age range, 31 to 50-year-olds. How many of them saw pornography before puberty? 13%, right? Now internet age. People that grew up with some form of, probably in this age, 25, 30-year-olds. So these are guys or people who grew up, they at least had dial-up, maybe broadband, right? You see, like, this trajectory. And this is 25 to 30-year-olds. If we did this to 15-year-olds today, I'm pretty sure the normative age of seeing pornography now is 10, I think. It's really low. Like, it's really low. It's going to just keep getting lower, right? Because accessibility. It's literally, we were talking about that earlier, it's literally everywhere. My kids can't not see it. It's going to be somewhere. Driving here, that disgusting Danny's billboard is pornography. Like, you can't. We used to drive, we'd have to take 220 to go to church from Clinton, and we'd have to be like, oh, kids, look, there's deer. Look at those deer over there. Every time. There's never deer. We lied to our kids for years going to church to avoid that stupid billboard, right? It's everywhere. And this is probably considering, you know, like, hardcore type porn, softcore, hardcore. But if we think about pornified kind of cultural things, it's 100%, no doubt. All right, so this is have received at least one nude image electronically, and this is going to be men and women. I want you to think for a minute, how many men, what percentage of men have received at least one nude image on their cell phone electronically, or I guess email and stuff? And then think what percentage of women received at least one nude image electronically, okay? This is 16, so this is years ago. So men, it's 57% of men have received at least one nude image. Now think about how many women. All right, raise your hand if you think there's more women women have received more. All right, raise your hand if you think women have received less. Yeah, you're right. Women have received statistically quite a bit more. 69% of women have received at least one nude image electronically, right? And you think about, like, this is the whole Brett Favre scandal when he played for the Jets, right? That's the first time. It was so scandalous back then. It's not scandalous now. It's very normal. This was in 16. How many of you guys have worked with adolescents? Okay. Yeah, in one way or another. I promise every one of those that just raised their hand would say, yeah, I've definitely had kids traumatized because they got a nude image or they were asked for nude images. It's just constant. Like, you have to ask. I would say this too. I meant to say this earlier. The reason I'm pushing this stuff so hard is you've got to be able to ask hard questions. You've got to be able to ask your questions. I don't ask my clients anymore, do you look at pornography? I say, how much do you look at? And then they can go, I don't look at any. Like, they can, but normalize it in a sense of, like, I know you're looking at it, so how much are you looking at? And then follow that up with, okay, what kind of pornography are you looking at? I don't like that question, but it tells me a lot about what's going on with them. We're going to talk about that later with treatment. What they're looking at tells you everything about what they're after, typically. All right, so let's look teens now. 13 to 17, came across porn weekly. This is the Barna group study. This is teens 13 to 17 in 2016. Accidentally, they 21% came across accidentally, and then 18% came across it intentionally. I'm actually thinking I don't know if that's right or not, but it's maybe the wrong slide. Anyways, is a lot, right? Come across it intentionally, accidentally. Teens seeking it out. You know, 57% of teens seek it out monthly. A lot of teens use pornography. That's kind of what I'm getting at. Tons of teens use it consistently. Again, they're moving a lot more towards producing it. Like, that's more of what's appealing now. Like, to get a nude image, it's... Like, probably, like, you think about the movies and stuff of the 70s and 80s, that kind of that conquest mentality of men, right? I'm going to sleep with Sally Jane, and yeah, I'm a man now, right? Now it's shifted to, I'm going to get the nude. Like, that's kind of the thing. Like, look at my collection of nudes. It's like baseball cards. Like, where to me as a kid, nudes are now to most teens. So that's the population as a whole. And we would like to think it's got to be different with churchgoers. We would like to think that. And it's just not. Just get ready. Like, it's just not at all. Men, churchgoers viewing it at least once per month. 64% of self-identified Christian men view pornography at least once a month. 15% of women view it at least once per month. This is the craziest statistic of all of these, right? So churchgoers compared to non-attenders, people that don't go. And this is from, this is quite a bit older. This is in 2000. So this is still with dial-up, right? So think for a minute what you think that is. Churchgoers compared to non-churchgoers. Do churchgoers use more or less? Just kind of get that in your head. All right. With regular church attenders, they are 26% less likely to look at porn than non-attenders. But with fundamentalists, self-identified fundamentalists, they are 91% more likely to look at pornography than a non-church attender. And you think about why that is, right? And fun Muslim being all about keeping the rules. Pornography is the easiest way out. And when we look at how did Jesus apply the law, he applied the law to let you know you're a sinner and you can't do it on your own. Right? And so fundamentalism typically thinks, I can keep this, right? I can do this. Porn is such an easy way out. There's so much I want to say there that I'm not sure if I should say. Let me think for a second. I have a problem with saying things. Don't encourage me to say things. That's why I'm avoiding this side of the room where my friends are. I don't need to hear from you. No, I'll just say... I was very fortunate to work with a lot of people in ministry. Like, that's become part of my niche for whatever reason. Just a lot of ministers come to me. Some of the more horrid things I've ever worked with was with pastors. Sadly, a local pastor just committed suicide just like recently because of this stuff. People, you guys would know him. And I would encourage you to pray for, I don't say that to shock you, like, pray for his wife and kids, please. It's such a problem. It's such a huge problem in the church. Porn use among pastors. This is among you guys here too. This is no different at RTS than anywhere else. It's at least 1 in 5 youth pastors. These are the ones that admit to it, right? Pastors are known to lie about this kind of stuff, so... 1 out of 5, 1 out of 7 senior pastors, and this is using it regularly, not on occasion. This is a regular, habitual, I'm using pornography regularly. This was back in 2016. This means, for the RTS professors, who I'm grateful that are here, at least 20% of the students on this campus are using pornography. At least, statistically. That's a really conservative number. At least 20% of future pastors. And how much do we talk about it? How much do we address it in class? I never did, like that I can remember, with all my biblical studies classes. I don't remember a single time of it being addressed. And I didn't take all the classes, we'll say that. I hope it's addressed. It's such an issue. And if we don't deal with it in our training, there's 0% once you get in the pulpit you'll deal with it. Because once you get in the pulpit, the way the American church works, now you're on a pedestal. Now you can't have that flaw, right? I always joke, the only way you can talk about sin from the pulpit is it's used to sin, right? I used to do this, but I'm better now. And it's like, oh, great, I can applaud that. But if you get up and say, you know, I'm still, man, this is a thing. No, we can't do that, you know? And so pastors get even more just stuck in this corner to where they can't talk. They just can't talk to anybody. So it's such a big issue, such a big issue. And so I would encourage you, pray for your pastor. Pray for the leaders of your church because it's going on with them. It absolutely is. We'd be naive and foolish to think otherwise. And it's definitely going on with our students here. We're going to talk about how to address that maybe here a little bit further. So if that's the case, pretty much everybody, basically statistically, almost everybody you know is using or has used porn. Pretty much. Statistically, that's kind of where it's at. I want you to put in your head, what's the number of churches who have a ministry for people that are pornography strugglers? So think about this. This is kind of that general broad scope church, American church thing. Churches with a ministry for pornography strugglers. Get it in your head. What percentage do you think it is? 7%. And this is recent. 7% of churches have a ministry for pornography strugglers. Why in the world is this the case? Why? Every church I know has a ministry for finances, right? Helping us with finances. We're greedy. We're Americans. Like, we need that to be taught in our church. Churches have all kinds of groups, but they don't have groups for people dealing with sexual brokenness. It's just not a thing. And if they do, and this, I'm going to step up on my soapbox. If they do, it's the super secret group that meets over there. Nobody can know about it. It's like Fight Club. Somebody's going to invite you in. And I hate that. That angers me to no end because think about the message it sends. We got a secret group for people like you. What message is that? It means this is shameful. We can't have this. So my challenge to you guys that are going to the pastorate, to you counselors, to you people that are in church now, get a group in your church that meets on Wednesday nights, out in the public, out in the open, right? For people with sexual brokenness, which is literally everybody in the church. You, like, saying, oh, we live in this fallen world. We are all affected by it. Everybody in here is affected by sexual brokenness. If you watch TV or read books or anything, or drive down I-220, like, you are affected by the fallout of sin. It is a shame, and it has perpetuated this problem to no end that the church has not addressed it, and still won't at all. At this point, pretty much when the church talks about sex or sexuality, it's to guard themselves theologically. Here's the fence we're going to put around us. It's not to deal with the hurting people in the congregation, which is most of them. Statistically, most of them are affected in this in some way. Parents are freaking out because they don't know what to do about their kids. Husbands are in total shame. Elders and pastors and deacons are using it and can't talk to anybody about it. It's such an epidemic, and we don't do anything about it. It's just absurd to me. Like, there's nothing more absurd to me than this. Maybe if it comes up, which I'm all about, I'm an expositional pastor, absolutely. Guess how much sex comes up? Quite a lot. There's plenty of opportunities to talk about this stuff from the pulpit, talk about it honestly. So I would say this. If you're a student here, and your professors aren't talking about this stuff and what to do about it, ask them. Ask them to. And if they won't, harass them, right? There's nothing wrong with that. They need to. They need to be dealing with it. If they feel inadequate, there's plenty of people that can talk about it, I promise. So get people to do this. If your church isn't doing anything about it, respectfully take it to the leaders of your church. Say, hey, we need a group. They say, well, on sexual brokenness. Well, we don't know what to do. Say, there's like a million books written on this subject. There are all kinds of DVD curriculum videos on it. And pastor, you need to just go to the class. You don't need to lead it per se, but you need to show up. Just be there. And send the message like, this is something we can talk about in this church. This is something we can deal with and are willing to deal with and face. Because it's getting so much worse. And you tag it back with violence. And there's so many correlations with domestic violence, all this stuff. So I'll step off my soapbox. So, why do people use pornography? So, we know pornography is the porn is the dehumanization of people through viewing some sort of sexual thing. We know most everybody has used it, is using it, or will use it, including women and children. So why in the world do people use pornography? Basically, I love this slide. Serotonin, dopamine, technically the only two things you enjoy, right? It's because the kooky lady that talked earlier, because it is arousing. It feels good. It's a really good thing. Our sexuality and sex is a great thing that God gave us. It was a gift, right? It's a nice thing that He did for us. It feels good. Basically, bottom line, one of my favorite guys, so I'm in AA as well, in recovery from alcohol, and one of my favorite guys, who will go unnamed, he would, every AA meeting, he'd go, my name's Joe, and I drink because I like to get drunk. And I was like, yeah, that's honest, man. Like, that's it. Like, there's no big reason. I do it because I like it. It's pretty much. But what's going on? We all love brain stuff. This is, I don't know where I stole this from, but it was a really fun slide. So dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, we all like brain science. Like, that's the big fun thing now to talk about. So what's going on? What does porn give you? I'll read you a couple things. Repeated consumption of porn causes the brain to literally rewire itself. It triggers the brain to pump out chemicals and form new nerve pathways, leading to profound and lasting changes in the brain. And so if you think about a neural pathway, I always think about it like a trail in the woods, right? A new one is like walking through the woods with a machete, cutting stuff down, I'm kind of blazing out. If I use porn continuously, particularly high-speed internet porn that's mixed up with this cocktail of violence and all this other stuff, it's a profound hit, right? It's like using morphine or heroin. What's going to happen? Now, the more I do it, the neural pathway is going to build out. Now, when I feel sad or whatever, that's like a 6-lane highway with a Corvette sitting on it. Like, it's boom, take off. So we do this stuff because it feels good. The more we do it, the more it wires the brain to do it again. It's how our brains work. It's do what works, you know, and it worked. It made me feel better. Porn does all these things. Dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin makes you feel good. Oxytocin in particular, right? It's called the cuddle hormone. That's what I always heard it talked about. That's the hormone that's released when a mother breastfeeds. Think about what's going on there. All the nurture, the good, healthy attachment that's going on. Oxytocin is the hormone released during orgasm. Part of what oxytocin does is it takes away fear. It kind of shuts down the fear center of the brain. This is why 99.9% of men fall asleep after sex, is because they don't have any fear for the first time all day. No, I don't feel any stress. Poof, you know, fall out. All three of these things, and in this you saw love spiked all three of those. Guess what? Pornography mimics love. It's a false alternative to it. So three reasons, besides just it feels good. That's really genuinely the answer. Three reasons people use pornography. One, they use it to regulate emotions, right? Porn equals false coping. When I say false, I always think about it. It's like Chinese food. I'm hungry. I go eat Chinese food. I feel immediately satisfied, and then 20 minutes later, I'm hungry. Now I'm bloated, and I feel shame, right? It's the same thing with porn, right? Then, so, to regulate emotions, then to feel connected. Porn is false attachment. Your brain doesn't know the difference between this image, this moving image, and this person. It doesn't really know the difference. It's still triggering all the same good stuff as if it was a real person. So you feel attached, you feel connected, which Carolyn did such a good job earlier of talking about. We are designed for that. I'm going to talk about that later, too. You can't live without it. And then third, we use porn to escape pain. Porn equals false safety. And you think about those three things, coping with emotion, safety, attachment. Those are kind of some main words that we kick around, especially in therapy world. So emotional regulation, pornography equals false coping. Where did you learn to soothe your emotions? Where did you learn to calm yourself? Right? Mama, right? That's who teaches you. Dads kind of help out somewhat, but it's primarily mama. We learn to soothe as children, right? From the age like 0 to 4, that's kind of the prime time to learn how to soothe my emotions. When our first daughter was born, we had no idea. We read all those stupid books that said, leave them in the crib, let them cry. I don't think that was the best thing to do. We didn't know what we were doing, right? We didn't know how to regulate our emotions. And so how am I going to help this kid do the same thing? All right, so this is the still face experiment. Who's seen this before? Raise your hand. Okay, so some folks. This is crazy. Dr. Tronick, he's a brilliant guy, I think at UMass. Yeah, and so this is from 2007. He'd been studying this, the infant response. So this is just such a crystal clear depiction of how we learn to soothe. So watch.
Babies this young are extremely responsive to the emotions and the reactivity and the social interaction that they get from the world around them. This is something that we started studying 30, 40 years ago, when people didn't think that infants could engage in social interaction. In the still face experiment, what the mother did was she sits down and she's playing with her baby who's about a year of age.
I'm my girl.
Oh, and she gives a greeting to the baby. The baby gives a greeting back to her.
Yeah.
This baby starts pointing at different places in the world, and the mother's trying to engage her and play with her. They're working to coordinate their emotions and their intentions, what they want to do in the world. And that's really what the baby is used to. And then we ask the mother to not respond to the baby. The baby very quickly picks up on this. And then she uses all of her abilities to try and get the mother back. She smiles at the mother. She points because she's used to the mother looking where she points.
Yeah.
The baby puts both hands up in front of her and says, "What's happening here?" She makes that screechy sound at the mother, like, "Come on, why aren't we doing this?" Even in this 2 minutes, when they don't get the normal reaction, they react with negative emotions, they turn away, they feel the stress of it, they actually may lose control of their posture because of the stress that they're experiencing.
Okay. I'm here. And what are you doing? Oh, yes. Oh, what a big girl.
It's a little like the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is that normal stuff that goes on, that we all do with our kids. The bad is when something bad happens, but the infant can overcome it. After all, when you stop the still face, the mother and the baby start to play again. The ugly is when you don't give the child any chance to get back to the good. There's no reparation, and they're stuck in that really ugly situation.
That's most of your clients that are acting out and doing stupid stuff, right? They're just crying for mama. That's all it is, right? That's all it is. I would venture to say a good majority of people that are using pornography that come to you, it's because of this. They don't know how. They don't know how to regulate their emotions. They don't know how to deal with what's going on inside them. Most of them, they don't even, I call it Southern male syndrome, right? They don't even know what they feel. They don't know what's going on inside them. They just feel things. They don't like it. They don't know what to do with it. And so they need mom to soothe them. Why in the 50s, and so this is, just think about this, the primary pornography that started was focused on breasts. Why? Why would that be the case? Because you have this generation of men that are utterly unnurtured, right? And there's this obsession with, I need to be nurtured. And that feels weird and sounds weird, but bottom line, and no guy is going to come to your office and go, "Man, I've been looking at porn because I really needed my mom to nurture me as a kid." And it didn't, like, nobody's going to do that, right? But there's this need for this really good God-given thing, to be nurtured. And most men that I know haven't experienced and definitely at this point don't know how to experience it. And so a lot of what's going on is that. So what is healthy emotional regulation? I like this model. I think it comes out of DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. Carolyn mentioned it earlier. It's a phenomenal approach. Just in hell, it really, it's all about just teaching people how to regulate emotion. It's very simple. So you've got emotional mind, reasonable mind, and then wise mind. And so what it is basically just helping people to step back and be aware. What do I think? What do I feel? What do I want? What am I going to do in this? A big majority of my clients aren't there. It's just, it's like instantaneous. What do I feel? Oh, what am I? I'm doing something. There's no thought process to this thing happened. Now, you know, in the 12 steps in AA, there's a big focus on pause when agitated. Like, because alcoholics don't know how to regulate their emotions. They just react constantly. And so to step back and to take a breath and to think, okay, what's going on with me? What's happening right now? You know, what are my choices? That kind of thing. And so we want to help clients move there. And that's what good parenting is. It's really what it is. It's teaching our kids, give them the resources to be able to do that. Unhealthy coping is just stimulus response. You know, this thing came up, somebody said something to me, and I responded. And it's just this immediate, you know, there's no time for thought. And then later on I go, ah, I don't know why I said that, right? It's because our brain is wired to do what worked last time. Even if it didn't work very well, do what works. Anyway, so how that works is pain immediately goes to porn. I feel lonely, porn, right? I feel isolated, porn. My coffee's too hot, porn. Like, it's literally anything mildly discomforting, is porn's the answer. Porn's the answer because it is, right? Falsely, it is the answer. Something that goes with all this stuff we're talking about, even this morning she spoke to it, is like porn's not the problem, right? Food's not the problem. It's the solution. It just happens to be a crappy solution that causes a lot of problems. That's what it is with porn. So very similar. I don't actually talk about porn that much with my porn addicts because it's not the thing. It's just the thing they're using to feel better. Like, it's actually not the issue whatsoever. We want them to get here to where something happens and then I can step back. I can have some self-awareness. I can imagine, okay, what are possibilities? What do I want to do with this? Actually give my conscience time to impact me, you know, and then I can make a response to that. I can choose how I want to react to it. So people use porn to regulate their emotions, to feel better, right, to get away from pain. Secondly, pornography is false intimacy. It feels connected. I'm going to go through these seven desires of every human heart. Who's ever heard of Mark Laser? Raise your hand. Okay, he was a pioneer in the Christian field of dealing with pornography addiction. He passed away last week. If you don't know who he is, you've been impacted by him, I promise. If you've dealt with any of this stuff. He's done a great deal. He and his wife both, Deborah Laser. I'm going to give you later this sheet that's got resources and stuff on it. Several of their books are on it. They wrote stuff for the person in pornography, for the spouse that's been betrayed by it. They've written a lot of really good stuff. So they put in their book Seven Desires of Human Heart. So I'm going to go through these, then I'm going to kind of put them side by side with pornography. So one desire is that we be heard and understood. We long for that. Your clients that come in, the couples that are fighting, right, and they can't stop fighting, it's because they both just long to be understood. That's a core human need God put in us. It's not a bad thing. To be affirmed. I would say there's a huge difference between affirmation and praise. Praise is you did good. Affirmation is you are good. This is good about you. God put this thing in you. This is who you are, and it's a good thing. We long to be affirmed. When we don't get affirmed, we seek praise, typically. We long to be blessed. We are a culture that does not bless. We don't know how, right? You read scripture, you read most cultures learn. They know how to bless their kids, to pass this blessing on. We don't know how to do that. So where do kids go to be blessed? Typically to their fraternity and sorority. Like, that's the people they need to bless them because their parents tend not to or don't know how. We long to be safe. I don't even have to talk about that, right? We long to feel safe. I'll say this, the whole safe spaces and all, right? It's been blown out like, oh, that's just this whatever snowflake thing or whatever. That's not true. We all long to feel safe. It is a good thing to provide safety. I actually think most of my best work is just providing safety for a client. A lot of my female clients have never been around a safe male. And so I get to be the first one. That's all my work is. I'm going to be safe. That's it. That's the thing that I'm always thinking. How can I be safe in this moment? We long to be touched in good, healthy ways. We long to be chosen, right? I think, this is kind of funny, like, why was this a resurgence? Why was there a resurgence in Reformed theology in the last decade? That, man, we love this. Like, God chose me? Yes, all right. But for real, you think about the complete lack of it culturally, and then here it is in Scripture. That's a good thing. And we long to be included. I could argue that all this is going on in Scripture early on, even in Genesis, even before the fall. I could argue all that's happening. But I think we all know it intuitively. Yeah, those are things I want. Nobody in this room goes, I don't want that thing. Nobody did that, right? We all want these things. You think about what's pornography doing. Like, and let's just take a scenario of a guy that goes to pornography. Just, and let's say, like, actual pornography, not the horrid stuff we talked about earlier. When does a woman take her clothes off and look at a man and want to have sex with him? In real life, right? Genuinely. It's when she feels safe and when she loves him and when there's intimacy and when there's commitment. There's all these good and proper things, right? You feel understood when that's going on. You should, at least, in a healthy relationship, right? It's so affirming. So many men go to pornography because that's the only place they've ever felt like somebody likes me. I feel powerful here, right? I feel strong. Your brain doesn't know this woman doesn't know you. Your brain doesn't know that. Your brain is interpreting all these signals that the woman in the pornographic video or image or whatever, she's sending you all these messages that say, wow, you're really great. I really like you. And so your brain's kind of digesting all that. All that's going on, right? Or falsely. It's all falsely going on. Why is pornography technologically moving more towards touch with all the teledildonic and haptic and all that stuff, right? It's because I need to feel that stuff. There's this insatiable desire to feel loved, right? Dr. R, I don't want to give him too much credit. I feel like Caroline gave him too much credit. I don't want to overdo it for Dr. R. But yeah, that whole idea in his book on parenting, that love hunger, right? That's a proper word for it. We hunger for it. She touched on that same thing, and we, no one outgrows it. And you don't outgrow any of these as you get older. You don't. I really don't. I think, if anything, you become more keen to understanding them. And you seek relationships where that stuff's going to be fulfilled reciprocally. So this is going on. We need this stuff. Porn offers a false version of this stuff, but not the real thing. Imagine if you have not eaten in a couple of months and you're literally about to fall out and die, right? You are so hungry, your body's about to give out. And up here is a moldy can of Spam. That's the grossest image I can think of. Moldy Spam. I don't know if mold would grow on Spam because I'm not sure it's real. I like Spam. It's all right. But it's moldy Spam. You haven't eaten in so long. You're about to die. And you come up and you're about to eat. And I go, whoa, 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 whoa. Don't eat that. That's going to make you sick. You don't care. You're about to die. You got to eat something. Most people that come to your office have not experienced these things. For sure not consistently. They're not experiencing this stuff. So they're so hungry for it, they will go to even places that make them sick to get it. And pornography is an easy substitute for that. It mimics intimacy. And so when I talk about intimacy, I think there's five areas. There's mental intimacy, which is being able to talk about stuff. If you're in Reformed world, right, we're good at this part. We can talk about things. We can discuss things. We can explore new ideas, dreams, all that stuff, right? We can discuss politics, the weather, whatever else, right? That's what we go to. It's easy. Everybody in this room can talk about SEC football, whether you like it or not, because that's kind of the lubricant for conversation in this world, right? So I got to be able to talk about football. I don't care about it, but I got to be able to talk about it. So mental intimacy, we got to be able to connect mentally with stuff. Emotional intimacy. I use the analogy of like it's taking the Kevlar vest off, right? But it's not just that. I'm going to get vulnerable, but I'm also going to kind of put the loaded weapon right here. I'm going to let you know my fears and my wounds and my hurts, but also my dreams, my longings, which are way more vulnerable than my hurts. I'm going to give that to you. And hopefully it'll be reciprocated. We need to feel emotional connection. Emotion, a mentor of mine always says, emotion is to relationship what marrow is to bone. And you think about what happens if your bone has no marrow. It is extremely brittle, right? Emotion conveys a value. One of the things that emotion does in us is it assesses and then it displays and it conveys value. How do I value this thing? Why did Christ weep when Lazarus died? Because of the value he placed on those people, right? And so we need emotion, right? Anyway, here's another soapbox I'll step on. But emotion is not any more fallible than your cognitive thinking. And around here, we think it's like, well, rational thinking, I mean, come on, it don't lie. But your emotions sure do. No, that's not even the role of emotions. Emotions kind of help you understand how much you value something. So if you grow up in a home where your parents don't have any emotional, you know, like they don't show that stuff, even anger, you know, or if it's just anger, but if they don't show the whole spectrum of it, it's easy to feel like you're not valued, right? So emotion, we need that connection. Physical intimacy, non-sexual touch. The funnest thing ever to do is to get a high school football jock in your office and go, you know, you tackle those guys because you need physical intimacy. Like, that's what you need. But it's non-sexual. And nowadays, everything is sexual. So little is not sexualized. But we need physical touch. We never outgrow it. There's dozens and trillions of studies on we'd never outgrow it. And if you don't have physical touch, you die. The whole babies, neonatal babies, like they need touch. We figured out if they're just touched, they get better faster, right? Just skin-to-skin touch, all that stuff. Sexual intimacy. I think there's two, I don't know how to like frame this out, but there's two aspects of this. There's the sexual bonding, the connection, the erotic behavioral stuff, right, in relationship that is best when in committed relationship. That's when it's safe. All that other stuff's going on. And also to feel affirmed in your masculinity and femininity, right? God created us, masculine and feminine, to display his image. That's a good thing. We've got to be able to affirm that. This is like another soapbox, sorry. Part of what's going on, I think, culturally with this is for so long, American culture said, yes, we'll affirm masculinity when it looks like this. And so masculinity or femininity was all about externals, right? So masculinity was all about, I don't know, like in the 80s, having a big mustache, right? And smoking Marlboro Reds and stuff like that, right? There's this image of this is masculine, tough guy, right? John Wayne has sort of somehow influenced what masculinity in America looks like. And John Wayne died a lonely alcoholic. It doesn't work, you know, and the same for femininity. And now the pendulum swung from it's all about externals to now my sexuality is all the internals. What do I think? What do I feel about myself? It's all that internal stuff. Rather than sexuality being determined by what God says about our sexuality is, which masculinity in Scripture doesn't look anything like the American concept of masculinity. For me, I'll just kind of, I don't know, I'll just keep talking about this. I don't know if I should or not. But for me, the time when I felt the most affirmed in my masculinity, I was sitting in a men's group with a bunch of cool guys, tough guys, all that stuff, right? And I'm able to read and share poetry that I wrote. Terrifying. Like growing up, that was not good. Like all the bad nicknames I got for being a creative kid. I was a band nerd and an art kid. I was not a football guy. I was horrible at sports. And so for so long, felt like that part of me wasn't loved, wasn't cared for. But then you get it loved on, man, I mean, things can come alive. And so porn, now looping way back, porn falsely meets this, right? Whatever's in your head, that person on the screen is affirming. Oh yeah, you're a real man. Whatever garbage goes with that. And then spiritual intimacy. And Dr. Hurley said this. This is one of those brilliant Dr. Hurley quotes that he doesn't know he's being brilliant in the moment. He's just talking. He said, spiritual intimacy is being children of God before the face of God together. I don't know if you made that. I'm going to give you credit. So that's a good one, man. It's so right. It's not about doing stuff. I know people that do church, and they do prayers, and they do singing and family worship. They do all this good spiritual activity. There's no intimacy there. They're not children of God before his face together, right? We can do a lot of things with all this stuff and not have connection. But the way it works is they're gears. They're interconnected. You can't have one and not the others. So many guys will say, well, I'm just not an emotional guy. No, that's stupid. You have a chunk of brain devoted to that. You're not an emotive guy, right? You forgot or you didn't learn or you were shamed in emoting and showing it. You are emotional. You definitely are. You can't not be without a lobotomy. And we don't do that anymore, thankfully. What it is, though, so you think about this. With let's just go with pornography, for instance. If I grow up and there's no emotional attachment, right? So that gear up there is totally stuck. It doesn't work anymore. Yeah, that pointer doesn't work either. So the emotional gear is stuck. It's rusted stuck. And let's say I was even physically abused, right? That gear is all busted up, broken. It ain't turning, right? That's like, and abuse is like pouring gravel into this thing, right? It gets all stuck. Those are stuck. But God created me to where this has to work. I can't live without these things going on. Like, He created it in me. I need it. And so what people tend to do, particularly with pornography, it's like that sexual gear. They put all the torque on that gear to try to get the whole thing to turn, right? Well, sex is not the engine at all. And so what would happen if that's the case? And I grew up, the mechanical mind of my dad was, if it's rusted stuck, you get a hammer and you hit it a few times, and then maybe it'll get unstuck. That's a lot of your clients. Well, pretty much every affair I've ever worked with, like a couple in affair, it's this. They're trying to get intimacy. They just don't know how. And so they go to sex to try to boost the intimacy to get all this going on. And what happens? They put torque on sex, but the other ones are stuck, and you know, it just blows up every time. And so that's what pornography does. A little caveat. When all we do is talk theology at RTS, and that's our, man, we can have these great discussions about theology, and we have all this mental intimacy, but nothing else. It's the same. It's honestly the same thing. We use theology. We can use anything to try to get this thing to turn, right? But we need all of it, which means we got to be mindful of all of it. We got to do our work, get our healing, all that kind of good stuff. So mental intimacy, not mental intimacy, intimacy, that's part of attachment. Secure attachment. That's what we're after. And that's what porn falsely gives us. For a minute, you know, it'll work. It's like if you're sleepy and I say, well, you should go take a nap. And you say, well, I'll just drink another Red Bull. Okay, you can do that. And after like four or five and your heart's about to stop and you're dying and you're throwing up, like, yeah, it doesn't work. But it's the same thing, right? We need to feel connected. And then finally, one of the reasons people go to porn is it's a false sense of safety. Because again, in real life, the only time a woman's going to unclothe and come towards you, and I'm talking obviously more towards guys here, the only time that's going to happen is when she feels safe and you're safe and there's safety in the relationship and there's healthy emotional connection and all this stuff, right? That's the only time. And so it feels safe. And I feel, the other thing about porn is I'm in control of it, right? I'm controlling how this plays out. I can't get rejected here. I can click the X button, right? And I can get rid of it. I'm in control. So I'm not going to go big into detail on this. The ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experience. If you've not heard about it, look it up. If you're in the program or going to be in the program, you will hear about it. But it's basically this. A ton of research happened where they found these 10 things have a direct correlation of making you vulnerable to these bad things, right? To behaviors and physical and mental health issues. So abuse, be it physical, emotional, sexual abuse, neglect, that's physical and emotional neglect, and then dysfunction in the house. So out of these 10 questions on this big thing, if you answered yes to so many, you are now statistically more vulnerable to things, you know, these negative things happening, like participating in these negative behaviors, experiencing physical or mental health issues. And basically what it comes down to, the way I think about it is it kind of puts that in the soil, right? It's not determinative, right? You're not stuck in it. For a long time, I thought I was stuck in a lot of those negative behaviors and stuff because of what I grew up in. I'm not, thank God. Like, He's a healer. Like, we can move through these things. But I mean, it's a huge proponent of what's going to happen. And so, I looked for a long time on research. I just could not find any. It's got to be out there though, of higher scores, ACE scores leading to more porn use. I would assume there's something like that out there. But, in her book, Ruth Lanius's book, and several others, The Impact of Early Life Trauma on Health and Disease, The Hidden Epidemic, one of the things they do talk about with sexual behaviors in teens is that if you have four of those ACE scores, so if you had four of these, you grew up in a house where you were emotionally abused, and emotional and physical and sexual abuse, the part of your brain that registers pain is the same part. They don't know any different, right? So that whole sticks and stones break my bones, words never hurt me, it's the dumbest things. Whoever made that up, it's ridiculous. It will, and it hurts the same way. It functions different. So if you have four of these things, let's say you grew up where your dad put you down a lot, where there was not that healthy connection, that emotional attachment, where your dad beat your mom, and where one of your parents went to jail. Those four things, right? If that was the case, you're 25, in intercourse by age 15, there's a 25%, 26, 27% more likelihood, you're more vulnerable to have an intercourse by age 15 than somebody with zero to one of those things, right? Same thing with teen pregnancy and teen paternity, right? It sets us up, makes us vulnerable, it kind of like sets the stage for all these negative things to happen. You may be a skeptic on that. That's fine, right? This is science, you know, maybe it's wrong, maybe we're reading it wrong, something like that. This is crazy. So addicts reporting traumatic childhood experiences. I want you to think for a minute what you think these would be. I'm going to talk about substance addiction, gambling, which is a process addiction, and then sex addiction. So addicts reporting traumatic childhood experiences. Go back to those ACEs. How many substance abuse? It's 54% of people with a substance abuse. This was 2017. 54% reported some form of early childhood trauma. Okay? Gambling addiction. Think. Is that more or less? Gambling addiction. 74% of people with gambling addiction report childhood trauma. And then in 2012, sexual addiction. It is 91% of people with sexual addiction report childhood trauma. It's a direct correlation. Right? What trauma does to us. And we don't have time to go into it, but it sets the stage, right, for I got to learn how to cope. So you think about somebody that grows up with trauma. They don't learn how to cope, typically, because the house is pretty dysfunctional. Possibly there could be other things. But let's say it's in a house with all the four ACEs I talk about. They don't learn how to cope on their own because there's no nurture, right? They experience broken attachment. There's no safe connection in their home. You know, and then trauma, like what the trauma does physically to us, what it does to our bodies. And so they need a way out. Porn's an easy way out. It's an easy way to feel safe. It's an easy way to feel connected. It's an easy way to regulate my emotions. It's the silver bullet, right? If I do this, I feel better. Okay, well, I'll keep doing it until it takes over. I want to show this clip. This is Nadine Burke-Harris. She talks about it. Before this, she's talking about a lot of what I'm saying right now of all these things are caused by trauma as a child, but what's that mean? And she kind of targets the skepticism towards it.
Well, of course, this makes sense. You know, some people looked at this data and they said, come on, you know, you have a rough childhood. You're more likely to drink and smoke and do all these things that are going to ruin your health. This isn't science. This is just bad behavior. It turns out this is exactly where the science comes in. We now understand better than we ever have before how exposure to early adversity affects the developing brains and bodies of children. It affects areas like the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure and reward center of the brain that is implicated in substance dependence. It inhibits the prefrontal cortex, which is necessary for impulse control and executive function, a critical area for learning. And on MRI scans, we see measurable differences in the amygdala, the brain's fear response center. So there are real neurologic reasons why folks exposed to high doses of adversity are more likely to engage in high-risk behavior. And that's important to know. But it turns out that even if you don't engage in any high-risk behavior, you're still more likely to develop heart disease or cancer. The reason for this has to do with the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, the brain's and body's stress response system that governs our fight or flight response. How does it work? Well, imagine you're walking in the forest and you see a bear. Immediately, your hypothalamus sends a signal to your pituitary, which sends a signal to your adrenal gland that says, release stress hormones, adrenaline, cortisol. And so your heart starts to pound, your pupils dilate, your airways open up, and you are ready to either fight that bear or run from the bear. And that is wonderful if you're in a forest and there's a bear. But the problem is what happens when the bear comes home every night. And this system is activated over and over and over again. And it goes from being adaptive or life-saving to maladaptive or health-damaging. Children are especially sensitive to this repeated stress activation because their brains and bodies are just developing. High doses of adversity not only affect brain structure and function, they affect the developing immune system, developing hormonal systems, and even the way our DNA is read and transcribed.
She says it way better than I could, right? It absolutely impacts us. And so you think about with a porn user, and again, that continuum, if you were thinking on one end of the continuum, the guy that maybe does look at a still image of a nude woman and masturbates. Maybe that's over there. And then on the other end is kind of some of that more grotesque stuff we talked about earlier. And they can't say no anymore. What's going on? Why are they hooked? And it's that constant fight or flight. And then the problem with porn is it creates deep shame. How does shame feel? That feels bad, right? So it creates more pain. So now I got to run even harder away from it. I want to think for a second, though, about the 12-year-old boy. Right, so let's go again. Let's even say that the normative age for kids to look at porn is 12, which is, I think that's older than what it actually is. What happens? We talked about that earlier. The kid gets on, he gets on Google, and he goes and he just searches sex. One of our sons was young, he put in like bad girls or something. We were like, what? Where in the world did you get that? Some kid at school said it, right? Hey, you need to look up bad girls, see what comes up, right? Innocently puts it up, and then boom. The image comes up that I described earlier. Just absolutely horrific stuff. Let's say it's just mildly. This is mild pornography on the internet. Let's say that's what he sees. I would venture to say that's sexual abuse, right? His body, his mind doesn't know any different. If I were to go up to that kid on the street, hand them my phone, say, hey, kid, look at this image. And it's the same thing that he sees on his own. What happens to me? I go to jail for child abuse, right? Right. What happens, though, if he just stumbles on it on his own? Whose fault is it? Right. He's got nobody to blame but himself. And so you'll deal with that a lot also. A lot of people feel deep shame. Well, this was my own fault. I shouldn't have done that. You're a kid. You didn't know any better. You're just curious. It's what kids do. And so it leads to all this stuff. Gail Dines mentioned her earlier. She says it this way. We need to understand boys as victims of this predatory industry. And that's not taken away that this industry is absolutely predatory on females. But also, in addition to, boys who are exposed to mainstream online violent pornography, which is 90% of online pornography, are increasingly being traumatized by the cruel images that assault them when they put porn into a Google search. Research shows that an adolescent brain is primed for novelty and risk-taking. And the pornography industry has hijacked this developmental stage by targeting boys as potential consumers. Studies reveal that the more young people are exposed to porn, the harder it is for them to form intimate relationships as they move through adolescence into adulthood. She's the one that Zimbardo quoted as saying, men nowadays don't know the difference between making love and doing porn. There's no difference in their brain. Jesus says it this way. This is Matthew 18:6. He says, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone, which that's the thing that they mill like the grain in. It's huge. A great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. That is the harshest, I think, thing Jesus ever says. Like, it's better that we tie a millstone around your neck and throw you in the middle of the ocean than you cause a kid to sin. So what's that word cause mean? This is coming out of Strong's Concordance, scandalizo, right? It means to entrap, to trip up, figuratively, to make them stumble, to entice them to sin, apostasy, or displeasure. What happens to a kid who sees porn, like they don't really have a chance. They don't have a choice with this thing. It connects this neural pathway in their brain, right? It's causing them to sin. Particularly, there's obviously various degrees of this. But we could say Hugh Hefner is absolutely guilty of this, right? It's better, Jesus would say, that a millstone be fastened around his neck and thrown in the sea than to do what he's done. But it's not just him. Now it's all of Google. So who do we blame? It's so much more difficult now. Like, who do we point the finger at? I don't know. That lady earlier mentioned the girl talking about positive porn or whatever foolishness that was. Like, she mentioned in the UK, they're actually trying to ban porn. They won't even do that. They won't even touch that subject in our country, right? Even with conservative government, they won't touch that subject in our country because it's massive business. So I would say, a buddy of mine says this, a learned guy through experience. He's got a PhD in pain, right? And he says it this way. To not talk with your children is sexual abuse, right? Because the car's running, it's out in the driveway, kid's going to get in it because that's what a kid's going to do, right? Porn's absolutely everywhere. Their sexuality, their sexual thinking is constantly being bombarded by stuff. And if we're not dealing with it, we're not talking about it, they don't stand a chance. And I think that applies to us, right, in these helping fields. If we're not pushing this thing and talking about it and trying to make ways for people to have conversations and to heal and to deal with this, like, we're not helping. Right, we're letting them fall into a trap that we plainly see, because we're too uncomfortable with the, you know, pointing it out. Think about it in this way: pornography. A lot of you probably were exposed at some point to pornography. Think about your response to it. Right, silence is your first response. I can't talk about it, especially if you're a kid. What do you say? I don't know. I don't even know how to describe that thing I just saw. It's weird. A lot of kids would say, "Well, it was weird. I saw a weird thing." It leads to silence. It leads to shame. Okay? This is bad. I did it. Therefore, I am bad. Right? And it leads to a secret. Where do we see this toxic trio? We see it in abuse. Right? That's abuse wrapped up. I really, really think that pornography, particularly, I think it's destructive no matter your age, but particularly to prepubescent kids, it is absolutely sexual abuse. So how can we help, right? You may feel a little despondent. I hope not, but you may. How can we help? And I love this passage. I'm going to read more from that guy, Del Bruner. Matthew 5:29-30, Jesus says, "If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell." When I was a kid in high school, and I was a good church kid and all this stuff, I read that. There was literal times when I thought about this. Like, I should just gouge my eyes out. Can't stop, right? Gotta stop it. I don't know how, right? That's not what Jesus means, right? But shame begets shame. And so, it's kind of the way I read it. Del Bruner says it this way. The meaning of Jesus' challenge is to take decisive action against the habit, thing, or person that, though pleasurable and perhaps even seemingly indispensable for living, is in fact ruining our lives. I think he's talking to all of us, though, not just the person involved in that particular sin, but us as the church. We've got to take decisive action against it. Jesus does not advise cautious, gradual action. He counsels surgery and immediately. He does not advise band-aids. He commands amputations. This is not, I'm telling you, like having a nice Bible study on something like on, you know, good theology of sex. That's good and we need to do that. But it's not enough. Like, we've got to face it head on. We've got to talk about it. We've got to talk about it from every avenue in the church, I really believe. Not all the time, but definitely sometimes, definitely often. But I love this piece. The use of body in Jesus' parable shows that with Jesus, we're never dealing with just the soul alone. This is not just a spiritual issue. We want to chalk it up to that. We just, you know, you got to fight that sin. So many pastors say good things that are true things, but kind of miss the boat of like, well, we just got to fight this sin. So let's fight this sin. Yeah, that's true. But Jesus' teaching is always a body and soul matter. We got to deal with the whole person, right? So how do we help? We deal with the whole person, not just, you know, give them spiritual platitudes and all that kind of stuff. So, this is, I messed up on this. What to do when someone shares their struggle? So let's say somebody comes in your office or your wherever, a friend or a client or a parishioner or something like that comes to your office and says, man, I'm struggling with porn. I don't know what to do. What do you do? So here's four things. Four kind of like safeguards. Don't use cliches. Don't give them easy answers. Don't give them simple answers or easy fixes. Like, they probably already know all that stuff, most likely, and it's not going to help. So no cliches, no simple answers, no easy fixes. Observe, don't overlook. And what I mean by that is pay attention to them, pay attention to yourself, right? We talked about that earlier. A lot of times we can be dismissive, particularly if it makes us uncomfortable. Somebody will say something in session, like, oh, this. You're like, let's move on to this, right? Because I don't like how that makes me feel. So observe what's going on with them. Postpone judgment. There are times when client tells me something so hideous, so horrendous in session, I got to put off judgment, right? I've got to sit with them. I can't flinch. I got to be right there with them, loving them where they're at. And then later, I'm grossed out and I call a friend and I'm like, oh my gosh, this was horrible and I don't know what to do with it. Or a supervisor. That's what I meant to say. Only a supervisor. And then empathy. I was just seeing if you're paying attention. You weren't. You failed. Empathy. Feel with them. My hope for today was that you feel with people. Most people using porn don't want to. They didn't mean to in the first place. It probably was an accident. And they got hooked. They got sucked in. And they feel like horrible about it. Don't, like, you gotta have empathy. It's so healing. So let's take some scenarios. Somebody comes in. Let's say it's a middle-aged man. He comes in and he says, oh, I've been using porn for 15 years. My wife doesn't know about it. Nobody, this is the first time I've ever told anybody. I just feel so horrible. And you think, oh my goodness, you know what? This book just came out and it is just absolutely, it's the stuff right now. Like, if you just read this book, you'll be so much better. Remember this anagram. Nope. 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 No cliches. No simple answers. Observe. Postpone your judgment. And have empathy. Hopefully you can get this, right? The Bible verse that fixes there. I'm all about the sufficiency of Scripture. Absolutely. I believe Scripture is empowered by the Holy Spirit. Can to do things. Heal. I mean, I really do genuinely believe it. Probably, when you want to just slap a Bible verse on it, it's probably because you don't feel comfortable and you just went out. I'm not saying never, obviously, because I apply Scripture, but most likely, nope, right? Most likely. The easy answer, nope, don't do that. Doesn't work, doesn't help. And around here, I would say, they probably already know the Bible verse. They probably already beat themselves up with the Bible verse for the last 10 years and hear it from you. The amount of people I have who went to somebody, told them what was going on, and got that answer, and then they shut up for another decade until it got worse. Yeah, it's just not helpful. Am I going to 4 or 415? 415? All right, good. 415? Correct? All right, the time that you did blank. You know, I had a similar situation, and here's what I did. I started doing this, and I called a friend, and da-da-da-da. And all my problems went away. I was so much better. Nope, 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 nope. Because your situation's different. Again, go back to that ACE thing, right? I grew up with like six of those things. If you grew up with one of those things and you're telling me, like, oh, well, I looked at porn this one time and I felt bad. So I repented and then I just didn't do it again. And God took it away. And I'm sitting here going like, oh, wow, okay. Well, I was abused and all this stuff. But, oh, I guess I can do that. I guess that's how it works. Your answer it's not universal, right? Whatever you did. And if you feel the need to point out how wrong, because maybe they don't know the severity of this sin. They may not know it. Nope, 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 nope. They do. I promise. If they're talking to you, they know how bad it is. I promise. You don't have to tell them. So here's an easy model, I think, that has just made sense to me for a while. Of how do we change? Think about the story, maybe, a blind Bart, or the Roman centurion, Bartimaeus, I was in Young Life, so we called him Bart. That is a lot better. Roman centurion asking Jesus to heal one of his servants, or the lady that was caught in adultery and drug out in front of all the bad guys, and they wanted to kill her and stone her. Think about that situation. How does Jesus respond to those people who are absolutely either humble or humiliated, right? So they come to him in utter humiliation. Like the woman. She never says anything in that story. She sits there. And there's story after story like that. Or the Roman centurion that says, Jesus, you don't even have to come here. Like, if you just say the word, I know it'll happen. Utter humility, right? What's Jesus' response? Mercy, every time. Mercy. Your sins are forgiven. Like, they didn't ask for that, but he extends this incredible mercy to them. Then, after mercy, he says, now go and sin no more. Why do we think that we should put change on the front end of this process, right? When somebody comes to you in your office, they're probably feeling deep humility, most likely. Sometimes not. Sometimes a wife will drag her husband in, and I gotta beat him up a little bit. Like, there's sometimes that happens, but 99 out of 100 times, they're humiliated. They just got caught, something like that. It is not my job to change them. One of the things that I've seen a distinguisher going to what Mike said earlier of RTS and other places is that we actually believe the Holy Spirit is the agent of change. It's not up to me. I am not responsible for changing this person. I just got out of a job working with people that thought it was their responsibility, and it killed me. It was exhausting. Like, this is crazy, man. I can't change. I can't even change myself. I'm going to change you, right? But Jesus consistently, when we come to him with humility, he extends mercy, and then he calls for change. This has got to be the order. On the other hand, if it's somebody that comes without humility, think about like the rich young ruler comes to Jesus. Hey, what do I got to do to inherit the kingdom of God? Jesus says, well, what about the commandments? The guy says, yeah, piece of cake since I was a kid. And Jesus figures out what's the one thing the guy can't do. Let's tell you that. Why don't you sell everything, give it to the poor, then follow me. Jesus moves the guy to humility, giving him the possibility finally to receive mercy. We don't know what the guy did with it, but that's consistently the pattern we see in Scripture. And so this is our job. I think we're right in that mercy quadrant. I think that's what we do. We extend the mercy of Christ to people that come to us, be it our friends, our parishioners, our clients, whoever it is. And so that very much goes with that nope and anagram thing. So if we're doing that, what does that look like? So what are some next steps? And this order has to be in this order. You have to do that first thing in order to do this thing. I would say, when somebody comes in your office, you shut up and listen. You just sit with them, right? The most powerful therapeutic intervention I ever experienced, it was early on. I was a student here. I thought therapy was a bunch of fluffy nonsense. And then pain got bad enough that I went. And I'm sitting there, and I don't remember what I'm talking about. I'm looking down at the floor, and I'm talking about something. So clearly I'm in shame. I don't know what it's about. It could be a thousand. I felt a lot of shame, so it could have been any of that stuff. And then I look up, and the counselor, she's sitting there, and she's crying. And my reaction is, what's wrong with you? I'm like, why are you doing that? Right? Oh, my goodness. That mercy changed everything. It opened up possibilities, man, for the first time in my life. I felt like, wow, okay, you know, maybe I can take that in, absorb a little bit of that nurture, that empathy, that care. That's your job. Just sit with them. They feel so bad. I've yet to meet somebody that's deep in porn that doesn't feel absolute horribly about it. Maybe some narcissistic people that are in a different world, but most people that you're going to run into, they're already feeling so bad about it. They just want relief. Just sit with them. And then when they ask you, what's something I can do? What can I do about this? Then you can start leading them and guiding them in this. And so I think four things that I've found consistently helpful. First thing is help them find and schedule a session with a counselor that knows what they're doing. If this is somebody that's just saying, hey, I just started using porn and it's not a habit and I feel shame about it, anybody from this program can deal with that, right? Most pastors should be able to deal with that. I think that's not too extreme. But if it's somebody in the deep weeds and they're telling you stuff that you're like, your stomach's turning, they need somebody that's specifically trained with it. Not just like an LPC or MFT, but somebody that's actually got deep training. And there's a lot of good training. I'm a CSAT. I think CSAT is good, but there's a lot that people in CSAT world I would not refer to. Right? Because I don't know where they're coming from, or I do know where they're coming from. And so you've got to be, part of your job, I think, as a pastor or counselor or whoever, is to be in that community and know all the people around you. You are oftentimes a bridge to others. I was talking to Kathy earlier. I used to be a colleague with her. Or no, this was with Barb. Sorry. Barb earlier. And talking about, like, you got to know your limits. We've probably had this conversation, though. I know we have. You have to know your limits as a counselor, as a pastor. What can I deal with? What can I not? Find the people that are the resources that you can send to, right? Find them. Take them to coffee. Take them to dinner. Like, ask them questions. See where they're coming from. But that's your job. That is a responsibility of, I think, anybody in the helping profession to know the resources around them. Second, and I don't know why it's doing the numbers on this one. It's not on that. Help them find a group. They have to be in a group. If they're struggling with porn, it's probably because they feel detached from people. So what's the answer to that? Being with people. They need to be in a group. Jackson is, like, saturated with good groups, even for sex addiction stuff. I've yet to see that anywhere else. Like, this is a weird hub of good groups in this area. I would even say this, if appropriate, and you got to know your boundaries and all that kind of stuff, connect them to somebody that's already in the group, right? If you get a group going at your church, and it's a good group, and it's out in the open, right, and you know Fred is also in that group, then you can say, hey, you know, and you ask Fred's permission, you can say to your client or whoever it is, you know, Fred has given me permission. Man, he would love to, you just give him a call, he'd love to take you to the group. Like, figure it out. Be creative with that. And ethical, living your boundaries. Or go with them to it if it's a friend. I've taken friends to AA. Like, I don't have any problem with that, right? It is, that first meeting is one of the hardest things you ever do. Ever in your life. It's one of the hardest things you ever do. Then, so you get them connected with a counselor, you get them connected with a group, text them or call them after that, kind of that first session. This is thinking that they're no longer your client, they're no longer your, you know, like if they're in your church, right, you've kind of passed the baton. And that's the way I think about it, is you're running a marathon, you're not running the whole thing. You're definitely not carrying them through the whole thing. You're passing the baton to somebody else. Check in on them. Hey, how did that go? Right? It can mean the world to people. And then I'd even say follow up a week later after that. Just check in how they're doing. Obviously, this was hard because I'm talking to three or four very different groups of people. But these are some general guidelines that I found really helpful. If you don't know, like if that happens and you're unsure, and this is in all sincerity, yeah, talk to a supervisor. Talk to a mentor in your field. And if you don't have a mentor in your field, you're in big trouble. Find somebody that can mentor you, a pastor or a counselor that's older and wiser than you, or at least a peer, somebody that you can bounce things off of. So next step. So really, porn, fighting porn, right, so is doing something new and different. This is actually the key to all good counseling, is do something different. I always joke, like if I have a couple in and they're fighting, I'm like, all right, well, next time this comes up, why don't you just stand on your head? Like, what? That's ridiculous. But just change it up, right? There's obviously better things to do and worser things to do. But this is kind of what we're going for. We want these people to engage right in the middle, to where they're having healthy relationships for all that attachment stuff I talked about earlier. They're healing the pain, right? So they don't have to go to porn anymore for pain. And they're learning to regulate their emotions. Like, the core of that is where recovery happens. That's an absolute for everybody. Those three things going on, they can absolutely recover, no matter how deep in the weeds they are. And so you think about that deep porn as dehumanization. Recovery is really rehumanizing them. A lot of times, particularly if they're in some of that darker stuff, they've kind of lost the sense of their humanity and the humanity of others. You can help them restore some of that. So I want to pass this out to you guys. This is a handout. It's got a bunch of resources. Bill, could you pass this out for me? Do you mind passing out to one side and Bill on the other? This is not an exhaustive list at all. There's a lot of really good books out there. I would say this, too. I was thinking about this the other day. If you're a pastor and you have, you know, you're coming from RTS especially, you are going to have some really cool books. Some leather-bound, gold-inscribed Calvin commentaries. Like, it's going to be nice. Put the books behind your head when somebody comes to sit in your office as a pastor. Put the books right here that are talking about addiction, about pornography, about marriage. Put that word. When they sit down, they see it. Because it's an easy way in. They may come in your office and like, I don't know how to tell this guy this stuff. And then they see that book and they go, oh, what's that book about? And you say, oh man, I read this book. This is an awesome book. Yeah, have you ever read this book? I mean, it's an easy in. And so, again, just images a lot with this stuff. Send the message through your office, your setup, all that stuff, that this is okay to talk about. So there's, I don't know, there's a bunch of books. I tried to give you different categories for different things going on. And then at the, well, I'll say this too. So NCSAT, Certified Sex Addiction, that's through ITAP, International Trauma and Addiction Professionals. That's through Pat Carnes, the guy that was at Pine Grove. That's kind of his baby. It's way extremely secular. Like, it's way out there. There are things that you've got to have a strong stomach to sit through. But they've got a track called the Pastoral Sex Addiction Professional. And what that does is it just equips you to sit with people. Not to treat them, but to really care well for the people in your congregation and the people you work with. I would encourage you to check that out. So on this, at the very top, is my website and presentations. That will take you to all this stuff. I've got the slideshow on there. I'll put the audio and all that stuff later. I'm trying to think of anything else to this. There's lots of good clinics around. Most of them will cost a lot of money. A lot, very much like Carolyn said, a lot of times when you're working with people with anything extreme, they've kind of lost everything. So they don't have money to do these great intensives. Sometimes they do. And so you've got a piecemeal. Like, that's a big part of my job. I'm in rural Arkansas. I don't have any options. So how in the world can I kind of piecemeal? I don't have a psychologist or psychiatrist for probably 50 miles. So you've got to piecemeal a lot of things together to help them out. So there's that. So I think that's all I got. So we could, I don't know, what is this supposed to, if you need to leave, you're welcome to leave. If you have questions, you're welcome to ask questions. Is that okay? Oh, really? 4:30? Oh, well, let me go back now. I could talk about myself some more. I like doing that. So, yeah, questions. And I would encourage y'all, as you ask questions, leave out the personal stuff. If you have personal stuff going on, catch me later, and we can talk about that. Yes, in the very back.
Hello. How would you encourage someone in ministry or a counselor who has someone come to them, you know, seeking help with sexual addiction when they themselves struggle with some sort of sexual addiction and don't feel worthy enough to be able to care and help that person?
Sure. I say a lot of the expressing the worth to them, because they've lost a lot of that through the dehumanization of the thing, is just simply through the way you love them. The way you look at somebody when they tell you this stuff is absolutely everything. The healing that takes place when someone says, I can't believe I did this, and then they look in your eyes and you're still looking at them, and you're okay, and you're okay with them, does everything. That sends such a huge message. And I think just sticking with them. Some of the things I talked about earlier, especially if you're a pastor, that next step slide is, I think, probably more appropriate to you. I'm just following up and saying, hey, how'd that go? I'm just curious. Starting the group in your church to where there's out loud, it's in the bulletin, people see it, you know, that's huge. That's a great way to express worth. Any other questions?
Hey, so what would you say to someone who uses written versus visual porn, and kind of uses that as a defense against objectifying people?
That's interesting. Yeah, no, that's a great question. It's the same. I mean, it's the same. It's still objectification, and it's words. There is a sin. This is what's wild. Older men that I work with, that are full on in pornography addiction, the things they remember are the stories they read as a kid. Like, God created through words. Words hold immense power. Like, there's no way that words are less powerful than visual. Men are more visually attuned. So a lot of times the words are going to be more with your women clients or female clients, but not necessarily. And so I think, no, words hold immense power. And there's research on all that stuff too. But yeah, it's a good question. Yes.
Do you know anything about, is there research out there as far as you're talking about porn these days being violent, mm-hmm. and yet there's still being a rise of women mm-hmm. viewing porn. Mm-hmm. What is happening in women's mm-hmm. brains to draw them to violent porn against other women?
Yeah. I just think it's high-speed internet. Even girls, like when our daughter was like 4, she looked up avocados for a report at school, and it showed this woman holding avocados in her breast. And I was like, what in the world is this, right? I think the exposure to it, I mean, there's the cultural pressure of it. Their boyfriends are pushing them into it constantly. It's such a complex thing, but how many girls have parents talking to them about sex? Actually, skip this part. As a parent, what do you do? The rule of thumb I have is filters. That's all great. You should have that, right? You should have boundaries on stuff. But it's about awareness of your kids and talking to them. It's not a sex talk. It's a conversation. And it doesn't ever stop. You continually talk about it. Both parents. Like, it's not I talk to the boys and Renee talks to the girls. There's some things, right, particularly to some sexuality stuff. But we talk about this stuff with them appropriately. There's a lot of good books. I put some books on there that starts conversation. Where is it? Healthy Sexuality for Children and Teens. The Story of Me is a great book. It's a series of books. The American Girl Doll. What is that called, Renee? Yeah. Which is bizarre. American Girl Doll is doing as much or more than a lot of the church, which doesn't make any sense. But it's a great series on just healthy body stuff. Other questions up front?
How would you appropriately balance, right now, female mm-hmm. empowerment is so mm-hmm. big, and how would you balance, like, female empowerment and sexual brokenness, especially right now, where women are being encouraged to get more involved and mm-hmm. be more involved sexually and, mm-hmm. you know, reclaim their bodies for mm-hmm. their themselves as opposed to men?
Yeah, that's a great, it's interesting. And so most bizarre parts of, there is this big push, you saw it on that video, for women to make their own porn as a way to feel empowered. But you think about that, you are making yourself available for consumption by some other that's not giving you anything. And so the reciprocity of a relationship's absolutely not involved. And so I think, the church, you best get me in trouble. The church teaching about healthy femininity, and like that femininity was made in God's image just as much as masculinity, to display who he is. And it's incredible, and it's a good thing. There's a lot. Yeah. I'm going to stop. Thanks, though. Yeah. Any other questions? Last call. Yeah, one more.
I'm wondering, I was really interested in what you said about the correlation between the drug use mm-hmm. and the immersion mm-hmm. of pornography. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you've had any, like, just, like, rather than one-on-ones and trying to just nail the issue, mm-hmm. but fostering community and mm-hmm. getting people just to speak truth, speak gospel into each other's mm-hmm. lives.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe even take part in, like, trafficking, addressing the problems in the world right now.
Yeah.
So how effective would you say
it's? Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, there's so much. It's really, everybody could speak into something with the issue of broken sexuality. Everybody has something to offer, for sure. And like how to, I don't know how to answer that succinctly. But just having groups in your church that are open and available, reading books, like staying educated as pastors, staying educated as counselors on the whole of the issue. I don't know if that's answering your question, but it popped in my head, so.